So this morning I pick up the paper, and right across the front, of course, it's about Ebola in New York City and Ebola in Dallas and who knows where next. We get on a bus to come down here, and there's an announcement on the bus about packages. If you notice a package, you better see something. If you see something, you got to say something because it could explode. It could be a terrorist bomb. Droughts, global warming, floods, revolutions, beheadings. And to top it all off, I just had to have an ingrown toenail worked on this morning. So things are really bad. But luckily, you have this show, The Turning Point, to bring you a little cheer in your day. Stay tuned for The Turning Point. So if you want to get in touch with me about anything you hear on this show, you can do that. This is the age of too much communication, and why should I be any different? The Feder Files. If you want to get in touch with me, go to Feder Files, F-E-D-E-R-F-I-L-E-S, F-E-D-E-R-F-I-L-E-S, and there will be a way there at that website to contact me. This appeared in the paper the other day. France moves to clarify restrictions on full veil. Paris. The government said Monday that it would circulate guidelines for cultural institutions on France's law against wearing full veils in public places after a woman, this is for women, after a woman at a performance of Verdi's La Traviata was asked by an attendant to remove the covering over her face or leave the audience. Jean-Philippe Tillet, the associate director, not bad, right? And that's just from high school French when I was 15 years old. He's a natural flair for languages. I know how to pronounce it. I just don't know what anything says. Jean-Philippe Tillet, The associate director of the Paris National Opera told Agence France-Presse that some performers had complained after spotting the woman, who was sitting close enough to the conductor to be visible on the television monitors at the Opera Bastille. The performers at the October 3rd production said they did not want to sing if the woman kept her face concealed, he said. How odd, right? Quote, I was alerted in the second act, unquote, said Mr. Tellier was quoted as saying by the news agency. The Paris National Opera declined to elaborate, but the cultural ministry, confirmed the account. In 2010, the French Parliament voted to ban the wearing of clothing that conceals the face in public places, becoming the first European country to restrict a custom that some Muslims consider a religious obligation. The so-called burqa bill, which is not really a burqa, it's just a, I forget the name of it, but it's a full veil, and there's a veil that covers the face, which also bans the wearing of masks, balaclavas. You know, balaclava is what, when you see, terrorists or the Ukrainian, the Russian-Ukrainian anti-government forces, they cover their faces because they don't want to be recognized. Presumably so they could be hunted down by the United States and other people with satellites, whatever. They cover their faces. That's a balaclava. The so-called burqa bill, which also bans the wearing of masks, balaclavas, and niqabs, which cover the face, went into effect in 2011 and does not forbid the wearing of the hijab or headscarf. Those who conceal their faces, whether at a museum, opera, or public garden, face a fine of 150 euros, that's about $192, though officials said the law had not been fully enforced in an effort to minimize tensions, after creating a whole lot of tensions by passing the law. The episode illustrated the conundrum for public venues, many of which said they had no formal procedures in place to deal with a woman who concealed her face at a performance. The cultural ministry did not detail what its instructions to cultural institutions would say. They just passed a law, and it's up to everybody else to figure it out. A ministry official, who declined to give her name because she was not authorized, blah, 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 said the episode at La Traviata was the only one she knew of in which a woman with a covered face had been asked to leave a cultural event in Paris. The covered woman, who French news reported, who came from a Persian Gulf country, according to the French news, was at a performance with her husband. A male staff member of the opera told her that in France there is a ban of this nature, asked her to either uncover her face or leave the room. They refused, and the man asked the woman to get up, and they left. The people left. It's never nice to ask someone to leave, he added, the opera official, but there was a misunderstanding of the law, and the lady either had to respect it or leave. The ban, which has tapped into a culture war over the separation between mosque and state in abidingly secular France, has been contested by some French Muslims as an impingement on their religious rights. Elsa Ray, spokeswoman for the Collective Against Islamophobia in France, called the episode an outrage. Moreover, she said the Opera Bastille had breached the law by asking the woman to leave, and only a police officer was permitted to enforce this ban. Opera officials said they could have called the police, but they preferred not to. This episode shows that people are using vigilante justice to enforce the law at a time when women in full veils are being physically attacked on the streets of France, she said. And yet, in Iran, it says, according to the papers, that women who are not wearing full veils, are being attacked on the streets of, of the various cities in Iran. So go figure, right? I mean, some right-wing extremists in Iran are throwing acid in the face of women who dare to reveal their faces in public. So in France, you have to have the veil completely off. What a world. The woman and her husband, according to this spokesperson for this group, the woman and her husband paid dearly for those opera tickets, and it shows that the atmosphere of hate in contemporary France is very strong. Edward Dagger, a spokesman for the Théâtre de Châtelet, a leading Paris theater, said that since the law had gone into effect, that the theater had never had to eject someone for wearing a full veil. Normally, we would do a check at the entrance of the theater, he said. A theater is a public space, so we have to uphold the law. While a full veil was not permitted in the audience at the Opera Bastille, veiled women are appearing on stage this month in a production of Mozart's The Abduction from the Seraglio, or Seraglio, set in a Turkish harem at the Paris Opera's other theater, the Palais Garnier. Just carefully file this. So what have we got here? France, a notoriously bigoted country, and also a colonial country. They've put this law into effect because they're terrified of terrorist behavior. They want to, and, you know, like other colonial countries, they have a lot of people from places that they conquered and raped and looted for hundreds of years living in their cities, especially places like Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. So this is a real case of karma, actually, of course. They conquer these places. They treat people like dogs. There are revolutions to get rid of the French. And then the people are in such dire poverty often that they come to France because there's nothing else for them to do in their own countries, and they're starving, or the politics there are terrible. There's no democracy. And what happens is they show up in France, and there are, because of racial hatred and because of bigotry, and the French got used to referring to them the same way that they referred to other people that that were part of their various empires all over the place, you know, Vietnam and other countries in Africa. The French had, looked down on them. They had slang words. They had pejoratives for these people. And now there are hundreds of thousands of them, maybe a couple of million of them, living in various cities like Marseille and Paris. And a lot of them live in slums because where there is poverty, there is a slum. And there is also a high crime rate. So one thing is leading to another. The high crime rate. And then, of course, there are people who have been known to leave various European countries and indeed the United States to go over and fight with various quote-unquote terrorist groups, some of which really are pretty awful. But this is a kind of terrible justice on the French. And you might, I mean, can you look at both sides of this issue? Is it fair to look at both sides of it? The French are generally openly democratic, and they have an open and a free society. They believe to a certain extent, or as far as they can go in the modern age, in equality between men and women, although I'm sure it's, you know, not complete, just the same way it's not complete in this country. But they cannot tolerate in their very closed and very sort of narrow French culture. If you go to France and you don't, I'm told, I have never been to France, but I am told by everybody who goes there that they're not very friendly to tourists generally from other places. You know, if you're not French, you're not happening. You know, they tend to be rude and look down on people. These people, the Muslims, usually the Arab Muslims amongst them, are treated very badly. And like I say, they live in the poor parts of the cities, and there's high crime in the cities too. Obviously, this woman and her husband going to, an important opera house, probably it's the same as in this country. They probably paid hundreds of dollars each for their tickets, so there's no crime being committed. And it's very unlikely that this woman and her husband were terrorists sitting in the audience there. But people are scared to death these days of terrorism, of suicide bombers, and terror acts, you know, against public places, you know, like trains, train stations, airports, and maybe with some justification. You know, 9 times out of 10, these suicide bombers are coming from the Middle East someplace or from Arab Muslim countries. And again, the French have, a tradition of democracy, the same as England does. But there are cameras on every street. I don't know how it is in Paris, but in London and other cities in England, there are cameras on literally every street. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of people who spend their entire professional lives monitoring camera footage or recording or going over camera footage of street corners and street crossings and subway stations and airports, looking perhaps for people who they are suspecting of coming into the country to do harm to the country. And there is justification for this. You can't say there's no justification for it. But they do have an open culture and a society in which, and that's basically what democracy is about. It's or one of the things it's about is being open and free and equal. And to do that, you have to sort of show other people who you are. To walk around, it's almost like anti-democratic to walk around covering yourself up. Now, like, for instance, under the law, and the law in the United States is, I'm not sure if it's the same as other Western democracies, but it might be, the law says you have a right to face your accuser. Say, in a legal case, you have the right to face your accuser. And that's part of what I'm talking about here, is that when you're walking around on the streets of an American city, you expect to, and somebody's talking to you, or somebody comes and applies, you know, for a license or something, or comes into a public place, or you see somebody at a restaurant, you don't expect them to be covered up. It makes you sort of nervous almost instantly. Now, we don't live in that culture. You know, if you went into a cafe or a public place or an office in Tehran or in Cairo or in Damascus or, you know, some other cities there, you might just be completely used to seeing women covered, either completely covered up or with half veils or full veils. But people in Western democracies tend to look at this as possibly and, you know, as a kind of inequality. And it does not fit. It goes against the grain of what people feel to be equality and an open and free society. A lot of the Muslim Arabs, the women are veiled because they are either forced to be veiled by men, or it's cultural pressure or religious pressure, and they buy into that. And democracy is not supposed to be like that. And it's a kind of a free and open thing. Like I once, back in the 70s, after hippiedom had died, after the Vietnam War, in the 70s, everybody was walking around sort of lost. You know, they had no Vietnam War to fight anymore, and all the hippies were now in their early 30s. And they had to finally face the fact that they had to pay rent and get jobs, and all of us. Not that I was a hippie, but part of that generation. You couldn't just take 6 months off and go to Kathmandu anymore. Or some people did that, but that's not what everybody was doing again. Finally, in the 70s, people woke up and said, I'm getting a little older here. Maybe I want to settle down. Maybe I want to have my life planned ahead a little bit. Maybe I need a job to pay the rent and buy food. You know, maybe just walking around smoking pot and listening to music and walking the streets and crashing at people's places is not going to work forever. And maybe it didn't work so well to begin with. So people, but what happened was one of the leftovers was astrology and all kinds of spiritual crystals, palm reading. That got very big. Not really during the 60s. That was more like sex, rock and roll, and anti-war activity and revolution. But after that, people fell back on all kinds of crystal readings and magic crystals and palmistry and astrology, very big in the neighborhood I lived in Park Slope in Brooklyn. And I, you know, was fascinated by that stuff always. I studied palmistry and knew a lot about palmistry. And one of the things in palmistry is that, and these things are all very obvious when you think about them, or most of these things are obvious, that if somebody, when you tell somebody to hold up their hands to you, if they hold up the back of their hands, what are they hiding? Or if you see somebody walking, do you ever see anybody walking, and I've done this sometimes myself, there's psychological reasons for it, somebody walking with their hands behind their back, you know, they walk along the street, you know, they look like they're in a contemplative mood or reflective mood, they walk with their hands behind their back, and it makes you feel like maybe they're hiding something. I mean, one of the oldest gestures in the world, and this is universal, almost universal throughout all kinds of ages and societies, is the way people who greet each other use their hands. Some in India, they will put their palms together and bow, But a lot of times when people are meeting each other in strange circumstances, or they have, or in potentially hostile circumstances, the most universal thing is for them to put their hands out to show that there's nothing in their hands. This is an old cultural, historical thing. Or put their hands up in the air to show that they're not hiding anything. And it's a similar feeling, I think, when you read an article like this. And it's not something you see in New York City. I don't know how it is where you live, but I doubt it's that way. Unless maybe you live at, there's a, what's that city in Detroit that's a very large city, not Detroit, in Michigan. Very large city, which is almost a majority. It is a majority of the residents are Muslim. I don't know if or if there are Muslim neighborhoods in New York City where women wear veils. But I don't. You hardly ever see that on the streets in Manhattan, where I live. You just don't see women wearing veils covered up. And it's a similar feeling. I think if you saw women here, it's just a cultural thing. Now, you do see Orthodox. The closest thing you see to that in New York are Orthodox Jewish women. But they don't cover their faces. They the men have them, the men, and I don't think the women choose to do this, the men have them covering their bodies up. They, in some extreme cases, their heads are shaved and they wear wigs. Go figure it out, right? But it's just something that's imposed by men. And a lot of cases, they are dressed extremely conservatively, and they have dresses that, you know, that come down very, very far on, you know, on their legs. But you see the same thing with Muslim women in New York City, too. They are dressed very conservatively. A lot of time they're wearing headscarves, and you can't really see too much of them. But you can see their faces. So you don't often see a veil. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen a woman walking the streets in New York City or on a bus or in a public place wearing a veil. So can you say that the French have some right to do this? But of course, people are complaining because this is an impingement on religion. This is mixing up the separation of church and state, which is extremely strong in France. I mean, you know, obviously it's an important thing in this country, but it's always been argued about. But in France, it's extremely strong because the churches during the French Revolution, up until the French Revolution, I should say, and even after that, were in complete collaboration with the nobility. In fact, sometimes they were the same people. So the corruption and the tyranny that was practiced in France that led to the revolution and lingered for some time after that was so bad. And this is the same thing that happened in places like even more modern places in Spain in the war between Franco's Franco's right wing Nazi type people and the Spanish Republic. There was the communists who were in charge of the Republic. A lot of cases they burned churches. They burned churches and they stole stuff that belonged to churches. They just burned them down because it was the church and the nobility, the church and the monarchy, the church and the tyranny that was practiced by upper class families, including police tyranny and the abrogation of democratic rights, was so complete and so ultimate that they identified the two together. Same thing happened in Russia during the Russian Revolution. So in France, they feel very strongly about separating church and state. They don't want the two together. Well, but what that means is that you should have the right to practice your religion. It just should have nothing to do with the government. The government should not be influenced by any sort of religious pressure or run on religious grounds. And I'm obviously completely in agreement with that, as are, I think, most people who understand what democracy should really be about. But here, a lot of Muslims are complaining that this is an ancient cultural tradition, no matter how much people in the West may see it as something that women are being forced to do by men. And I think a lot of people do see it that way. I see it that way. I don't think women would choose. If you could, make it a secret ballot and have all the Muslim women in the world vote in a totally secret ballot, whether or not this is some fantasy, right? Whether or not, even in Arab Muslim countries, if they could vote whether or not they're going to wear a veil to cover themselves up, either completely, a whole body, a burqa, to cover themselves totally where you can't see them at all, in all kinds of hot weather and every other circumstance, I'm sure that 90% of them would vote not to cover themselves up. Why would anybody even want to do that? I suppose, you know, that this really is something that's I do assume that this is something that, that men are doing. They're forcing women to cover up. And the French really don't like it. But nobody has passed a law like the French have. Nobody has passed a law. And why are women made to cover themselves up? Well, it's the same old that we've talked about here. Because men look at women in a lot of places and in a lot of lands. And, you know, it's not so long ago that it was this way in this country, as property, that women belonged to men, that they had no rights. They had no right to vote. They couldn't own property. And they were part of a man's property. And this is especially true whether or not people can justify it or rationalize it any way they want. But in conservative Muslim countries, that's the way it is. I was in Turkey once, a long time ago. It was 1970. That's going way back, right? Went to visit. No, it was 1972, 73. I went to visit my father, who was living in Istanbul. And I saw women with veils on and, you know, completely wrapped up. But a place like Istanbul also had a lot of European influences. So women there were very modern and looked like European women. But when we went out of the city, you would see, and this is something I saw once, and it was remarkable. I still see the picture in my mind of a man walking along. This was about 30, 40 miles outside of Istanbul in a small village that we passed by on the road, going at a slow pace just to take in the scenery. There was a man walking along with a donkey behind him, and the donkey was piled up with a bunch of, and the man was walking by himself. He was just leading the donkey, and the donkey was piled high with firewood, you know, and kindling, and behind the donkey was a woman completely covered up with a veil, a full veil, also carrying firewood and kindling. And seemed like she was being, treated the same way as this man's donkey was. And I said to my father, he said, it's different places. You got to adjust to where you are, different places. But I didn't like the look of it. But that's why women have always been treated that way by men. It's because they sort of feel like they're their property. And that involves a feeling of control. I mean, look what's going on in Iran right now. In Tehran, they have conservative, ultra-conservative, fundamentalist Muslims driving around on motor scooters and motorbikes and in cars and stopping to throw acid in the face of women who do not cover themselves up. This is how insane this is. And I'm not equating this completely or, you know, in an overwhelming way, but you've got ultra-Orthodox Jews on the streets of Jerusalem spitting at women who do not dress in the fashion that they think they should be dressed in, you know, who are not conservative enough for them, for their taste. And I think this, I've said this before, but I think it comes from a fear of women's, a fear of women. It comes from fear. Control, as I understand, and I know a lot of people, other people understand, a desperate need to control comes from fear. If you're afraid of things, it's almost like in the same proportion. To the extent that you're afraid of things, you feel the need to control things all the time, to the point where you can't even control things. You know, obsessive compulsive behavior or controlling everything in your environment, making sure that there's absolutely no noise, there's no mistakes, there's no problem. The more somebody is afraid of not having things exactly the way they need them to be for some reason, who can understand, you know, maybe that's to each individual, they have to exercise control. So I think men are afraid of women. And what they are afraid of, to me, is, and this is getting very heavily psychological, but I believe that women have a certain natural connection to the earth that men don't have. They give birth to children. They carry children around inside them. They are more natural in a lot of ways than men are. And if you disagree, you disagree. And once again, if you want to get in touch with me about any of this, I'd be happy to respond. You just go to FederFiles, FederFiles.com, and you can get in touch with me that way. And I think men also are afraid of their own sexuality. afraid of the power of sex. They're afraid of the power of sex. It all starts with the Garden of Eden, right? That's what the entire story is about. I've had arguments with a friend of mine who says it's about a lot more than that, but an Orthodox Jewish friend of mine. But that's what it's all about, is a woman, a naked woman, is the one who caused all the misery and pain in the world. After God, a man, and Adam, a man, got deceived by this by the machinations of this evil naked woman, that was the beginning of the end for all men, you know, and for all human beings. And they were punished with misery and pain. That's a heavy load to put on women. And this has been going on, and it's still going on in the United States, in different places, and all, and in a lot of parts of the world. This is the men are often, especially in primitive places, call it that, in places where there is no equality, there's no, there is less rationality in an equality in the way a society or a culture is run. Women, I think men are afraid of the power that women have. Women have an innate power that's sexual and natural that men don't really have. And I think a lot of times they feel like they have to control it, which is why they do this. So women are, and then women buy into, a lot of women buy into it. You know, they get as angry sometimes as the men do because they're not allowed to wear their veils or to be covered up or to practice these, to me, very demeaning rituals. The men basically have them under their spell.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up?
Some people get a little carried away by this. You know, obviously, Mr. Hawkins there, that's Screaming Jay Hawkins. I wonder how he got that name. You know, he feels very strongly about that. But it's this men, it's men imposing fashion on women. You know, for most of the time I've been alive, until actually the last 20 or 30 years, but that's a lot of time, right? When I say most of the time. But it was, you know, there's always the fall fashions. There's always the fall fashions. And there's a big fashion show in New York City, actually. It's called Fashion Week, in which women are decked out in the newest fashions. And these fashion shows are really more like art shows. It's almost like gallery art shows. Because a lot of these fashions, although they dictate what millions, even tens of millions of women will have available to buy that year. And of course, it has to be changed every year, or else how could fashion companies and dress companies make money? If it was always the same fashion every year, even if it's it's the same thing every year, then there's no reason why that people would go out and feel like they have to buy something brand new with their money and waste their money on a $700 dress or a $600 pair of shoes. I'm sure I'm way off if you're rich. Maybe a $2,000 pair of shoes and a $10,000 dress. So, but this filters down. These fashion things filtered down. But men, it's part of the same thing, that men were always the designers. I mean, recently, one of the most famous designers in the world, clothing designers, Oscar de la Renta, died. And, since I was a kid, you read about the fall fashions and I don't know the names all the time, but the fall fashions have come out. And, it seemed to me 7 or 8 times out of 10, maybe more, these were women's shoes and dresses and even new hairdos and blouses. And is it blouses or blice? What is the plural of blouses? And why isn't it blice? So it's women's new blice and their, jackets, everything, skirts. Everything gets redesigned every year. It's because these people are creative, but it's also for business purposes. It's like annual planned obsolescence. And it's not just that these things are, the fashion shows where you see women, walking down the catwalk in that bizarre walk where they all look like they're robots or vampires, and they walk down that catwalk, all of them a little too skinny for my taste, but that's the way it goes. And they're wearing the brand new clothes, and there's applause at the end, and people are brought out, and there's tremendous, and people go into passions, and they go into swoons over the designer comes out at the end of the show. Beautiful what he put on these women, what he draped these women in. And these women are almost like, they're called mannequins, by the way. They're called mannequins in some places. The models are called mannequins. It's like a mannequin in a store window, like a store dummy, like something that you actually, that just exists for people, usually it was men, to put the latest fall fashions, to put on women to make them look sexy. So men very often, and I think that's changed, though. I mean, here's something which I know not that much about, so I'm willing to be corrected completely by anybody. But for a long time, and maybe still to this day, a lot of men, sometimes it's straight men, sometimes it's gay men, design these fashions, and that's what they think a woman should look like. And that's sometimes what they think is sexy on a woman. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong. And this filters down. It's not just the rich people who shop in New York City on Madison Avenue and on various other, cities where they buy, go into clothing stores where they have armed security guards for the clothing stores. It's not just that, because all the fashions then filter down to mass production. So all that year, like for instance, was it 2 years ago or was it 1 year, last year or the year before, women were wearing these absurdly stupid looking shoes. Sometimes these fashions are created by men who have no idea, or women for that matter, who have no idea what women what is comfortable or what is even good looking or what is even sexy for women. Yeah, I know it's all a matter of opinion. And here I am indulging in it like I know, right? But, it's up to women to decide what to wear. But sometimes they are at the mercy of fashion designers and mass marketing chain department stores, which carry the latest fashions. Because sometimes there is almost nothing available. If they want to buy a different kind of shoe that's more comfortable or that looks better on them, good luck. You have to spend extra money or go around or wear last year's shoes, God forbid. And or if you want to buy a dress that doesn't have a certain kind of weird design or cut, good luck to you. You have to go and find it someplace else. And this has been going on and on and on forever. And even if men didn't design fashions, and I don't know how far back this goes, but But even in the Victorian age, women were, and this changes over the centuries. I think it was in the, what was it, the 18th century, that women had their busts, you know, their breasts revealed in almost every circumstance. If you look at movies that were made of Jane Austen's novels, it was the fashion then, and I forget what it's called. Was it Georgian? I don't know what the style was. But that's the late 1700s and the early 1800s. Women's fancy dresses were very revealing for breasts, although the gowns were still very long. Very, very bad to see women's legs, because God knows what could happen then. It has the power of an unleashed atomic bomb, right? And this has been this way. Did you ever look at women tennis players? Did you ever see pictures, old pictures of women tennis players from the 20s and 30s? They played with these absurd long skirts on that came all the way down to their ankles. Women were supposed to cover up. And you've seen this. And maybe there are some women who are listening to this show who are old enough, but I doubt it, to remember. I mean, there were one-piece bathing suits and then bikinis all the way back to the 40s and 50s. But women, it was a big thing for women, both men and women, I should say. But it was a big thing for women to go bathing almost completely covered in clothes. And it still is in some places, of course, where there is fundamentalist law applied. Where there is fundamentalist law applied of almost any religion, it's considered indecent, generally by men, for women to go into a public place not covered up in some fashion, according to the way they want, that men want them to be. And to me, fashion is, and in Victorian age, women really covered up. And that was part of that whole Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the suppression of all sexual feeling, the suppression of almost all emotions. And women had the worst of it. This is where Freud got all the fainting women from. And, this is where women had swoons all the time and where the idea of hysteria was developed. Well, it wasn't originally developed that way, but that's where Freud, you know, made a big deal out of it. Women's emotions, their sexuality was completely suppressed. And the higher up in class you went, the worse it was. But the middle class and the upper middle class that Freud dealt with, and even the upper class, there were strict rules on what you could wear, especially in these class societies. And women, generally speaking, were covered up then, too. Especially Victorian women had to wear these bustles. They had to have this hourglass shape, which can be very attractive. But still, it called for them to be extremely uncomfortable. In fact, in some cases, painfully uncomfortable. And this is from all the way through the whole Victorian age, way into the early 1900s before this started to change, where women were wearing bustles, corsets, all kinds of things where they had to be laced into them, and they had to, you know, they could hardly breathe in any kind of formal occasion. But the whole idea of fashion, I'm not a good person to comment on this, because I've never had much interest in what was fashionable. And if you could get a look at me, you would see why. I mean, I am just not the kind of person. I mean, you know, it's not just women who indulge in fashion. I mean, men do too. And yeah, certain clothes look good on you and certain clothes don't. Certain clothes are good for you. For certain people, certain colors are good. Certain shapes, certain cuts of things are good, and they're not good on other people. But since I was a kid, and this is probably for various psychological reasons, I've always worn almost exactly the same thing. I've worn jeans and sneakers and flannel shirts and during the summer, T-shirts. That's all I ever wore. That's what I still wear, except when I'm required. 2 weeks ago, I went to my daughter's wedding, and I had to buy a pair of shoes. I didn't have a pair of shoes. I had to buy a pair of shoes. I had to buy, I had some formal pants that were left over from 10 years before when I worked in an office for a while, or 15 years before, I think. So I had to get those pressed, and then I had to buy a pair of shoes, and there was also a sport jacket left over from, 20 years ago when I worked in an office. And I had to wear these shoes and wear these clothes, and it made me very uncomfortable. But what's interesting about it is that it makes you feel, and is this part of what you buy into because it's cultural? It makes you feel grown up to wear this stuff. You know, there are dress codes almost everywhere, although there's less and less of that now. You know, in the tech world, where you see people are sitting on floors or wearing jeans or T-shirts and making, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 a year, and it's totally informal. And they still do a very good job. I think it's somebody like Steve Jobs who started this whole trend of, I don't think it was Bill Gates so much, but Steve Jobs especially would come out in his jeans or corduroys and his black T-shirt and sneakers or, you know, casual shoes. And here's a guy who's worth, you know, billions worth, billions, and a funny old phrase, who has billions and billions of dollars, who is the director of a company when he was alive that had more, that was one of the largest, if not the largest company in the entire world, had more, assets and more cash than any other company. And he sauntered on stage with this. And this is considered a big thing in the tech environment. But still, in most offices where there is stock trading and bonds and stockbrokers and lawyers' offices, any place like that, it's a jacket, it's a suit and a tie and very fancy shine shoes and jackets and ties. And it's like a uniform. There are dress codes in various different places. I suppose if you went into a tech office, especially someplace in the Silicon Valley or something like that, you went into a tech office dressed in a suit, you would feel totally out of place, uncomfortable, and probably would be laughed at by other people there. And, you know, lose the suit, they would tell you. But this is a whole thing about uniforms. And it's a kind of an offshoot, I think, of what I was talking about before, that people impose, and sometimes where this imposition comes from is mysterious. People impose their idea of what other people should look like. Maybe it comes from above, right? You know, the church was always involved in this. Religion has always been very heavily involved in, again, with women, but also with men, in what you're supposed to dress like according to how God wants you to look. Of course, it's how a bunch of men over, you know, millennia want you to look. It has nothing to do with God. And there's nothing that I ever saw. It doesn't say in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not wear a bikini or thou shalt wear a suit to work. it doesn't say that anywhere, right? The idea that people picked up, that people wear all these outfits and headdresses and black coverings and burkas and this all stuff is very, very, very strange and imposed generally from the church or from society in general. And I buy into it, and you have to buy into it. In a way, if you showed up at an office dressed in the way I am, like in jeans and a flannel shirt, you would be asked to leave. When I was working at a law firm about... this is a long time ago. I worked as a paralegal in various law firms. It was a conservative law firm. And that's saying a lot because a lot of law firms are conservative just by nature. People dress they don't want to look like they're casual or loose or in any way not dressed with the right probity, you know, with the right propriety. But I worked in this law firm, and the office manager was a woman who was very uptight, kind of conservative woman who was in her late 50s and dressed, as other people did in this firm, the women did generally, in dark clothes, very conservative, didn't show off much of herself, you know. And the men all had suits and ties on, and I got away without the tie. I don't know how I got away with it. Ultimately, I lost the sport jacket too. Why? I don't know why they let me get away with it. Maybe because I did a good job. I did a really good job. And somehow they just sort of left me alone. But there was a woman there. I remember it was an Italian woman, Italian girl, actually. She was in her early 20s from Staten Island, who was very sexy. Joanne, I forget her name. And she was very sexy. And she would wear these flashy clothes cut very high on, very high on her leg. You could see a bit of leg, and they were tight dresses. And at first what happened was an office memo came out. A general office memo was issued by the office manager saying women in this firm, especially addressed women, women in this firm are advised that there is a dress code at this firm and that I forget what the term was anymore. But any kind of attire that is not considered conservative or proper to the office will result in possible, punishment or something like that. Then, meanwhile, you know, she keeps wearing this stuff, right? And she's very sexy, and nobody cared. I mean, she did a good job. She was a really good secretary. Yeah, and the men stared at her. And when the clients came in, most of whom were men, other lawyers or guys, you know, clients who were, you know, CEOs of corporations or whatever it was, or the heads of various vice presidents of corporations, yeah, they'd stare at her. You know, she was sexy. And she was called into the office finally and warned that if she came in one more day dressed like this, just showing herself off, that would be the end of her. Sure enough, she shows in the very next day. I guess maybe she didn't want the job. Or maybe she had a job somewhere else. Well, she wasn't going to let somebody tell her how she should look, right? She was doing a good job, and what difference should it make? They fired her. They fired her. And there are, and it used to be much more like this. When I was out of college in 1966, and this is in the 60s, changed a lot of things. But in the 50s, especially, still through the early 60s and even into the mid 60s, when I graduated from college in the mid 60s, you went looking for a job and you did not show up without a jacket and a tie on and dress shoes, or even a suit and a tie on and dress shoes. Even if you showed up for a civil service job, which I did eventually, worked for the welfare department, you show up for the interview and the original training, and then even you show up on the job in the beginning until it got, you know, you got assigned to a neighborhood, and it didn't make any sense to walk around in a suit and a tie. It was absurd to be walking around a poor neighborhood in a suit and a tie. You know, it was just making yourself a target and sort of almost insulting other people who lived there. But yes, that's how you had to dress. And uniforms are fascinating to me, absolutely fascinating. You get autocratic societies like North Korea or places like China, but especially a place like North Korea, where almost everybody has to look exactly the same. And nobody is allowed to look flashy or to wear sexy clothing. Everybody looks like a robot. And that's almost the function, I think, sometimes of uniforms, is that people are required by religious institutions and by governments and by office, by the people who run offices, to wear uniforms, sometimes of a severe and often a very drab nature, to wear uniforms that that make them uniform. Literally, the word uniform, one form, no different than anyone else. That's where the word uniform comes from. And same thing with the Nazis. I'm not talking about fashion designers. And then I jumped to Nazis and wearing a suit and tie, and I jumped to Nazis. How did I do that? I don't know. Did I have any right to do that? But I did it. So, yeah, look at the Nazis. They wore these uniforms, and it showed that they were, members of a master group of people within their own society and a master race in all of society. And the women in Nazi Germany, the young girls at least, were told to dress a certain way. And it's always been that way. It's always been that way. But with me, I could never stand having a suit and tie. So it was just lucky for me that I was involved in various businesses and various places, like working in a bookstore, you know, an independent bookstore, or, working on my own, or working freelance, or working in a radio studio. There was a group therapy group that I used to belong to and recently rejoined because I needed. And they have a rule in this group therapy group that you have to wear what they call work clothes. Now, there's no tie required for the men, but you have to wear, you cannot wear jeans and sneakers in there because it sort of insults the other people, and you're acting like a child. Part of the whole idea was to communicate with other people so that you learn how to interact with people and you can grow up. And so you're acting as if. It's what the it's what AA calls acting as if. You wear these clothes, which are more, quote unquote, grown up clothes, and then you feel somehow from the outside in more responsible. So I've been doing this because otherwise I would be, causing a lot of trouble in the group. And, you know, the truth is, who knows? Maybe it is affecting me that way. Maybe it is affecting me that way. When you walk on, when you're my age and you walk on the street with your jeans and the sneakers, you feel comfortable. And I kept telling them down there, that is my, those are my work clothes. I work in a radio studio. I don't wear a suit and a tie, and I want to feel comfortable. But they said, no, when you come here, you have to dress like the rest of us. So, you know that old phrase, clothes make the man? I don't know. I could never understand fashion, it seems to me. And it's interesting, though. I mean, if it's an expression of art and you want to change it every year, but don't make people pay extra for it or have to ditch their old clothes. I mean, why would somebody feel embarrassed because they had last year's fashions? I mean, it seems to me that could only, that kind of attitude could only prevail among people who didn't have enough individuality to think for themselves. I mean, really, you just, but on the other hand, too, that's how many hands now? Four hands. On the other hand, what do I know about fashion and about clothing? I am, I've been wearing the same things, almost the same exact styles and cuts of things for almost 70 years now. So what do I know? I have no idea whatsoever. Some people like to dress up. It makes them feel good, and it makes them feel like they're expressing their actual personality to dress in some flashy or interesting way. And who am I to judge? That's the way it is.
Now, I've got a guy, and his name is Dooley. He's my guy, and I love him truly. He's not good looking, heaven knows, but I'm wild about his crazy clothes. He wears tan shoes with pink shoelaces, a polka dot vest, and man, oh man, he wears tan shoes with pink shoelaces and a big Panama with a purple hat band. He takes me deep sea fishing in a submarine. We go to drive-in movies in a limousine. He's got a Hurley Birdie and a 12-foot yacht. Ah, but that's not all he's got. He's got tan shoes with pink shoelaces, a polka dot vest, and man, oh man, he wears tan shoes with pink shoelaces. Now, Dooley had a feeling we were going to war, so he went out and enlisted in a fighting corps. But he landed raising such a storm when they tried to put him in a uniform. He wanted tan shoes with pink shoelaces, a polka dot vest, and that old man. He wanted tan shoes with pink shoelaces and a big Panama with a purple hat band. Now one day Dooley started feeling sick, and he decided that he'd better make his will out quick. He said,
just before the angels come to carry me, I want it down and writing how to bury me.
A wearing tan shoes with pink shoelaces, a polka dot vest, and man, oh man, tan shoes with pink shoelaces, and a big Panama with a purple hat band. And a big Panama with a purple hat band.